coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Unprecedented changes are coming to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, shifting more costs to the states. But Governor Matt Maher sees a possible silver lining.
I do believe there are inefficiencies, and I do believe in some cases, like in our SNAP program here in Delaware, there are inefficiencies that we need to work on.
We look at how hard Delaware will be hit by SNAP cuts. I'm your host, Tom Burr. We also examine a new effort to address maternal and infant mortality locally. Arts Playlist previews the latest Delaware Division of the Arts Mezzanine Gallery exhibit. And Enlighten Me focuses on a new living shoreline to protect Thompson Island. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Burr. Federal funding cuts are impacting states to varying degrees across the nation, particularly with unprecedented changes to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program known as SNAP. These changes were outlined in President Donald Trump's tax and spending package known as the One Big Beautiful Act, which for the first time ever will require states to pick up some of the tab for SNAP administrative costs. Additionally, beginning in 2028, states with high payment error rates will be required to pay for a portion of benefit costs, and Delaware had one of the highest error rates in the country in 2024. Delaware Public Media's Sarah Petrowich recently spent some time speaking with state officials to understand what these changes mean for Delaware and how the state plans to cover these unprecedented costs.
President Donald Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act was the legislation heard round the world when signed into law on July 4th of this year. The massive spending and tax bill makes several of the president's 2017 tax cuts permanent, adds provisions for no tax on tips and overtime, and increases spending on immigration enforcement and the military. But to help pay for those tax cuts and increased spending, the legislation made extraordinary changes to the Medicaid program, which provides health coverage to 70 million Americans, and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, better known as SNAP, which assists 42 million Americans in food access nationwide.
It will cost people their health care and their food. 37,000 Delawareans will lose access to help making sure they're not hungry. It's going to affect millions of people nationwide, but it's important to focus on what's it mean for us here in Delaware.
That's U.S. Senator Chris Coons speaking at a press conference just days after the bill was signed into law in July. The bill creates new administrative requirements and conditions on eligibility, including work requirements, for people seeking to enroll in or maintain Medicaid coverage. The Congressional Budget Office estimates roughly 16 million people could lose their health insurance coverage by 2034 due to the Big Beautiful Bill's provisions combined with baseline projections. While the bulk of Medicaid changes are coming at the end of 2026, Delaware's lone Congresswoman Sarah McBride warns the 124,000 Delawareans receiving SNAP benefits could see cuts even sooner. SNAP is a food supplemental program for low-income families. Funds are passed on to an electronic benefits transfer or EBT card, which can be used at local grocery stores. Previously, the federal government paid for 50% of SNAP administrative costs. Under the Big Beautiful Bill, that cost share will drop to 25% beginning in October 2026, which McBride worries could cripple Delaware's budget.
This bill will saddle our state with tens of millions of dollars in new costs just to maintain current food assistance. That is an unfunded mandate, plain and simple. That is a mandate that no state, alongside the cuts to Medicaid and other critical programs across the federal government, that no state can single-handedly or even jointly make up for without the support of the federal government.
Delaware Division of Social Services Director Tom Hall says that change will result in $16.5 million in additional spending for the first state.
The state's going to have to, you know, work to identify, you know, where those funds are going to come from.
SNAP benefit requirements are set by federal law, which means lowering the amount of food assistance offered to eligible individuals to make up for this additional cost isn't a possibility. But this influx in administrative cost is only the beginning when it comes to states picking up more of the SNAP tab. While states have always paid a portion of administrative costs, the federal government has historically covered the entirety of the benefits portion, amounting to nearly $100 billion last fiscal year. This equates to roughly $187 per SNAP participant per month. But that is set to change. Beginning in October 2027, states could pay anywhere from 5% to 15% of benefit costs if their payment error rate is at or over 6%. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, only 8 states fell below the 6% error rate last year, and Delaware's payment error rate last fiscal year was 12.37%. So what is the SNAP error rate? Hall explains it's a measure of administrative accuracy.
The rate reflects where benefits were overpaid or underpaid due to eligibility determination errors. You know, sometimes people think this is a result of fraud. It is not. It's more just about the administrative process that's used to determine the benefits.
While Delaware has one of the highest error rates in the country, it is only half of the highest reported rate, which belongs to Alaska at 24.66%. This prompted Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska to tack an amendment onto the Big Beautiful Bill, allowing states with a payment error rate of 13.34% or higher to delay paying for a portion of SNAP benefits for an additional 2 years. Delaware falls just one percentage below that threshold. Hall laughed when asked sarcastically if it would be easier for Delaware to simply increase its error rate by 1% instead of cutting it in half, assuring that the Delaware Division of Social Services isn't planning to take that route. Instead, he seems optimistic about reducing the error rate before the October 2027 deadline.
We are working diligently to lower our error rate. We cut it in half already from where we were in 2023. So our expectation is that we're going to be able to lower the rate more between now and the end of the next federal fiscal year. And so the likelihood is we'll be using that, the error rate that's calculated for federal year 2026 as our baseline year.
Some lawmakers and analysts point out the hypocrisy in asking states to lower their payment error rate while simultaneously cutting administrative funding, particularly when high error rates can in part be attributed to staff shortages and burnout. Hall says there's no doubt the changes make things difficult, but he is determined to work through the new requirements and make sure benefits are administered in a timely and accurate manner.
We already have processes in place to lower the error rates, but we're going to be ramping up even more to do more real-time expanded quality control efforts to catch errors as they occur and before they're put into a case.
Hall says his office will also work on client education to ensure applicants understand what documents are needed to accurately determine their eligibility. This relates to a third major change in SNAP. Starting next month, in October 2025, new federal work requirements go into place in order for individuals to qualify for food assistance. Previously, adult SNAP recipients had to work until age 54 to qualify, unless they were a parent with dependents. Now, the working age to stay in the program has been raised to 64, and only parents with children younger than 14 are exempt from that requirement. Hall expects the change to impact 12,000 Delawareans currently receiving SNAP benefits and likely result in a multitude of individuals falling off the program.
It's absolutely a challenge for some folks. I mean, there is no doubt about that. You know, are there jobs available to them based on the skills that they have in the area they live? So, you know, that's a concern. This bill doesn't take that into consideration at all, and actually changes, you know, the ability to even, you know, request waivers in some cases. You know, people will definitely leave the program as a result of this change.
Individuals will only get 3 months of benefits without complying, meaning those who do not meet the new requirements will lose benefits by January 1st, 2026. Hall says ensuring patients maintain SNAP eligibility will largely come down to education and making sure patients are aware of the new changes. The Food Bank of Delaware plays a large role in this type of application assistance, helping current and interested participants provide the right documentation to receive benefits.
It's just complicated. There's a lot of paperwork. It's sometimes, you know, really hard to understand. We have people that don't have the ability to comprehend and read the application. We have language barriers, and our team actually sits with people and walks them through that also. When they leave that meeting with our staff person, they actually have everything they need to apply.
That's Food Bank of Delaware President and CEO Kathy Konevsky, who points out while the SNAP outreach program will persist, the Big Beautiful Bill immediately cut funding for the SNAP education program. The SNAP education funding was used to help existing participants learn how to maximize their benefits and create nutritious meals. While Konevsky is thoroughly disappointed with the program's cut, her focus has shifted to ensuring SNAP participants can fill out the proper paperwork to maintain their access to food.
I can't imagine if I'm looking at something that I just don't understand and it looks too hard and it is what's standing between me and being able to get a benefit that's going to help me feed my family. It's just, it's hard, it's sad, and it's devastating.
While Delaware SNAP administrators and the food bank work to ensure participants don't lose benefits before January, the state is also beginning to consider serious budget changes to accommodate for the increased costs. Governor Matt Meyer is waiting on Delaware's Budget Advisory Committee, known as DFAC, to present updated economic figures in October, which will help determine the true fiscal health of the state. But previous projections have not been promising. Even after potentially dipping into its reserves, Delaware is currently expected to enter a deficit by fiscal year 2028. The combination of recent federal funding cuts, the drying up of historic federal investments by past presidential administrations, and Delaware's recent history of letting its spending far outpace its revenue growth put the state in a precarious financial situation. Despite recent dismal projections, Meyer appears confident the state will be able to cover a bulk of the program cuts.
Right now, we're looking at an overall impact of tens of millions of dollars. We have a $7 billion budget. So when tens of millions of dollars goes away, it's not good news. But it's a way, you know, you're talking about 1, 2, 3%. We think we can find the resources to continue, maybe not all, but many of these programs.
The governor also sees the changes as a chance to create more efficiency within the state SNAP program and potentially save some money along the way.
I do believe there are inefficiencies. And I do believe in some cases, like in our SNAP program here in Delaware, there are inefficiencies that we need to work on. And we need to make sure we're using the latest, greatest technologies. And maybe because federal rules in the past haven't been structured around it, we haven't really put those issues under a magnifying glass and fixed them. So we're also trying to fix some of these inefficiencies that we think is going to generate millions of dollars of savings for Delawareans.
While there is an opportunity to improve program efficiencies, Senator Chris Coons worries the impacts could extend beyond current projections, particularly in a small state like Delaware.
This is a program, as we heard today, where the folks who participate on it often come on and off. They come into benefiting from the program because they've been laid off, they've been widowed, they've lost their home. So a majority of SNAP beneficiaries are not on it for a very long period. So when I say 37,000 people are at risk of losing their SNAP benefits, that's actually going to ripple through probably 100,000 people over the course of 2 years. That's 10% of our state. If 10% of our state has a significant increase in hunger, and we've got a hungrier, poorer, less healthy community as a whole, that impacts everybody.
The true impacts of the SNAP program changes are yet to be seen, but Delaware will undoubtedly be faced with tough financial decisions in the months ahead. Sarah Petrowich, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sarah. And we continue The Green in a moment with a look at efforts to bring a maternal care center to Wilmington to address maternal and infant mortality. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The U.S. is one of only 7 countries to see a significant increase in maternal mortality rates in 2023, according to the World Health Organization. The U.S. sees steeper rates than any other high-income country, and maternal and infant mortality risks spike even further in the Black community. Delaware was among 7 states with the lowest maternal mortality rates in the nation in 2024, but Black pregnant people here are still significantly more at risk during pregnancy and postpartum, representing 45% of maternal deaths, despite making up only 21% of the state's population. The Delaware-based organization Black Mothers in Power wants to see those numbers drop in the first state. That's why it's opening a maternal care center in Wilmington, according to its founder and Wilmington City Councilwoman Shanae Darby. This week, Darby and Project Director Kristen Banger sit down with Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee to talk about the ins and outs of this new facility.
I know that you, Shanae, are the founder of Black Mothers in Power. Can you talk a little bit about the mission for the organization and also specifically for the maternal care center that's coming?
So Black Mothers in Power mission is to address the disparities that exist in maternal health care, right? So Black women are 2 to 3 times more likely in their babies to die or to have really poor morbidity rates. So our organization is looking to eradicate that, right? And also looking for solutions to addressing those problems. The mission for the Maternal Care Center it's a big mission, right? But it's really to create a one-stop shop where families can come and get all the services that they need that is connected or under maternal care center, from dental to therapy, domestic violence, housing support. We're able to wrap it all in one.
So, Kristen, as the project director, can you talk a little bit about how the Maternal Care Center's mission, as we've already discussed, kind of fits into the Black Mothers in Power organization and what you're hoping to bring to Wilmington?
So the ultimate goal is to bring a birthing center to this community, a much-needed birthing center. But in the meantime, what we'd like to bring is a building that houses all the pre-birth care and all the post-birth care so that people have a place that they can come to. My part of the project is actually designing it and implementing it, getting it up on its feet. So what we have embraced on the design and build side is a space that is not like any other medical space, a space that is comfortable, a space that is warm, that offers people a safe, caring, holistic place to be. There'll be no white coat syndrome when you come to the Maternal Care Center for Black Mothers in Power.
And we want to be able to break those barriers with culturally competent providers and being able to really look at that and bring that all together in our space so that it's welcoming, it's inviting, and it's breaking down those historical, systemic things that have existed to cause those barriers to people being able to get the care that they need.
Let's be perfectly clear. This is still a medical space. So it is going to have all the requirements and all the needs that they would have in a medical space. It's not going to be anything less than that, but it's not going to be cold and it's not going to be scary. To Shanae's point, a lot of people, especially people from disenfranchised communities, have a tendency not to go to doctors. And so they've had bad experiences or they've had a lack of ability to afford them. And we want to take those fears away and make this a place that not only they come to, but they repeatedly come to if that's the need.
Can you talk a little bit about why having one space rather than, you know, a five-stop day from dentist to primary care to therapy or wherever else is needed for folks here in Wilmington?
Well, when I think about the city of Wilmington, the majority of people don't have cars, right? It's like around 50%. And a lot of them don't have access to health care. And at that, if you do have health insurance, it's expensive, co-pays are high, like it's a lot of barriers. And when you have a one-stop shop, I think you break down those barriers. Wilmington is small. Well, Delaware is small. You can get through it in 2 hours. So I think having this in the city of Wilmington specifically provides that care for the whole city that is needed and it's accessible to get to. And it's right off of the bus line too. There's a bus that goes on Market Street. The accessibility would be there. If you have to walk, at least you don't have to go to Newark, right? It's like right there.
It's not just the services that the MCC is offering. It's also all the services that Black Mothers in Power is offering because the offices are going to exist in the same building. So it's not even simply the maternal care, but it's all kinds of other services will be available to them to at least reach out to and communicate to.
And I wanted to shift a little bit toward the statistics and specifically talking about maternal mortality rates, which I know that you've mentioned. The rate for 2023 was about 50 deaths per 100,000 for Black people giving birth, specifically according to the National Center for Health Statistics. And the disparity is high in Delaware too. 45% of pregnancy-related maternal mortalities are experienced by Black women, according to the Delaware Office of Women's Advancement and Advocacy. That's compared to 41% nationally. And Black people only make up about 22% of Delaware's population. Can you talk a little bit about what risks are involved with maternal care and just being pregnant here in Delaware?
Sussex is a little bit more rural country down there. Their care is spaced out. So I think their accessibility to care with transportation or even having a provider in their community at all, I think those are some of like the barriers they face. And then you come up to Newcastle County, which is more city-like. I think we experience the same things, but in a very different way. Like their transportation issues, we have transportation issues, but theirs is more because it's just doesn't exist and it's far in between. Ours is like the times that it run, right? Not enough buses. You're waiting for a bus for a few hours just for to get on a bus to go somewhere. So I really think it's like for Delaware, when you look at our landscape, It is the accessibility issue to getting to providers, providers being in the communities, and a lot of the OBGYNs are retiring or leaving Delaware. We just don't have enough capacity and people to even in the maternal care space to do the work that they need. Some people aren't being seen by a doctor well into their second term. So those are the things that we're faced with in Delaware.
Something that I've seen speaking with OBGYNs and folks involved in women in maternal health care is that they've seen more than 5 OBGYN offices close in the last year. And that's a huge number, especially for a place that's as spread out and rural like Sussex County, and I mean by extension, Kent County too, to a lesser extent. What does that look like for people?
What it looks like is you become pregnant, you look for a doctor, and you get on a wait list. Right? You call throughout the whole state trying to find a doctor to be seen. And if you do get one, they're probably hours away. If you don't have a car, you're going to have to call someone to drive you around or get on a bus or Uber. And buses, you know, are probably affordable, but a Uber, an hour or two away, could cost you a lot of money just for you to be able to get the services that you need. So that's what it would look like, right? How am I getting there? Who am I going to go to? But like those accessibility things that you need for your pregnancy, you're not going to get, especially in that first period of pregnancy.
But there's also a great lack of cultural competency. It's not just in Delaware, it's throughout this country. And the problems are everything that you said, Shanae. But the lack of cultural competency, which does treat women of color differently and doesn't understand the differences that women of color might have to face, starts a problem from the beginning.
And how do you hope Black Mothers in Power, and by extension the center, will work against and lower maternal mortality rates in the state?
I think the majority of pregnancies are healthy, right? And I think people should have options. I'm not saying everybody should come to a birth center. But you should have an option. If I want to do a home birth, if I want to go to a birthing center or a hospital, everyone should have those options. The maternal care center will offer in the future birthing experiences for the community so they can have an option. The maternal care center, which we're seeking to open soon, would then do the pre and post birthing experience that we can give to the community so they have an option.
I know that part of giving people options is I was tooling around your website and saw that there's a directory for care providers. Can you talk a little bit about how that plays into giving people options and agency throughout their pregnancy?
There's different types of doulas, traditional, non-traditional, full spectrum postpartum, abortion doulas. So I think having a directory gives people options.
And I also wanted to ask specifically at the center, will folks have an option to talk about doula services and maybe even just for people to come in who are pregnant and ask what are my options?
Doulas will definitely be a part of the maternal care center. I'm hoping that there are some doulas who will want to use the space full term to be there. So when moms or birthing people come in, that they're able to engage with them right there on the spot.
And what other options are you presenting to folks that come in?
We're building the space in order to incorporate all those things. Like we already have a therapist who'll be renting one of the spaces, leasing one of the spaces from us. So we have a lactation room. We'll have a dentist who will visit monthly or bi-monthly and work with people.
If people hear about this and they want to help, what opportunities are there for that?
This is a really aggressive project, and we've taken it on knowing that this is what Shanae and BMIP made as a promise to the community. But it's a project that costs money. So first and foremost, after partners and after community relations, we need funding and we need help in that realm always, and we'll continue to as we grow.
So we already talked about cultural competency, but I want to bring that back around and zoom in. Can you talk a little bit about why cultural competency needs to be at the center of the conversation when we're talking about maternal care?
I think that is where care changes for people, right? When you're able to say, how am I intentional in providing care for someone? So I think that is why cultural competence is important, especially for providers when they're interacting with people, so that they feel like they can return for care. They feel like they were heard when they walked out that room. They feel like their needs are being met. Immediately thought of like intersectionality. So the thought of I am a pregnant person, but I'm dealing with, I don't have stable housing. I don't have food. I'm in a domestic violence situation, or I might have substance use issues, right? So we have to be able to meet those needs too, to even address maternal care needs, right? I can go and I'm willing and open to figure that out of how to do that. If I'm not, I'm hungry, right? So I'm concentrated on those things. So we have to, in the maternal care center, address those needs because it's all intersected and connected to maternal care and the type of care someone receives, or even if they want to receive care or how they can receive care. So I think we have to hit those pieces and be holistic in our care.
Thanks to Black Mothers in Power founder Shanae Darby, Maternal Care Center Project Director Kristen Banger, and our Abigail Lee for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, and a preview of the latest exhibition at the Delaware Division of the Arts Mezzanine Gallery in Wilmington. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Delaware Division of the Arts Mezzanine Gallery in Wilmington continues to spotlight the work of First State artists with an exhibition next month by Paula Brown. Brown is a relatively recent arrival to Delaware, spending much of her life on the West Coast. Her work, much of it impressionistic landscapes and seascapes, shows off her adeptness with pastels and oils. And on this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny sits down with Brown to talk about her art, her background, and the importance of Bach, Brahms, and Dr. Seuss.
I want to start by asking you about your early life. You grew up in Seattle, and you spent a lot of your weekends on your grandparents' farm. And I wonder how having those sort of dual urban and rural experiences influenced your art.
My childhood was filled with nature. And wherever I went in Seattle, there were parks. So I was surrounded by greenery. And then on weekends, I'd go to my Irish grandparents' farm, a dairy farm. And then I'd spend my summers on my grandfather's and grandmother's huge, huge farm in Iowa. So it always has been a very inclusive situation for me with nature, city, and country.
You've called nature your muse, and you touched on it just a moment ago, but I wonder if you can kind of expand on the importance of nature to your work and what kind of inspiration you find.
Nature is totally the inspiration for my work because I also am a nature whisperer. So I hear the trees, I hear the ocean, I feel and touch the sky with my own soul. And so I get direct messages from nature and I translate those into the paintings via the dynamics and the power of light, movement, and value, and color. I'm a colorist. I'm more of an impressionist in landscape, cloudscape, seascape painter. And also I'm a sketch journaler of what nature has to say. So it totally guides me in my art. I'm a nature artist.
And you talked about color, and I want to follow up on that a little bit and just ask about the challenge, but also the joy of finding combinations of colors that are reflective of the just huge, infinite diversity of colors that are found in the natural world.
Color to me is all important, especially putting the vibrational tones of opposites together, much like the Impressionists did in Van Gogh. And I so respect that because there's a vibrancy in each color, and each color calls out for its opposite color or the mood that the landscape is communicating. If it's dark and moody, there's at least 5 to 10 colors in each shadow. And when you take a picture, you really can't see it. You need to be in nature a lot to just experience, and you need to sit in nature, and you need to see the light, you need to feel the light. And the color itself, it's the juxtaposition of opposites, of analogous, of primary, of secondary, and tertiary colors, and they just sort of flow out of my paintbrush or my pastel. I just let my heart guide my hand, and it picks the color it wants to represent the emotional aspect of the painting. Composition is how you invite the people into your painting. Color is the emotion you express in the painting.
I want to ask specifically about the work that you'll have on display at the Mezzanine Gallery, and I wonder if you could pick a work or two and tell me about them and what the visitors can expect to see when they look at your work.
I'm inviting the people to come into the flow of nature when they look and view at my paintings, and hopefully that happens. I've been told that my paintings are very healing and calming. And one good example is Cotton Candy Seaside Stroll. That's kind of a twister to say, but it's a cloudscape. The cloud you're going to see has many landscapes within the cloud. And the wonderful thing about clouds is they've all got a foreground, middle ground, background, and you can bounce around in the clouds, and it makes you very happy. And also clouds are shifting winds, and it's the dynamics of the transformation that is constantly happening in nature. On River Dance, that is done in Yosemite, these paintings that you're going to see in the gallery are from the West Coast, the East Coast, all my travels. I'm quite an adventurer, so I go and get source everywhere. But River Dance is extremely challenging to paint, and it's early in the morning of the lower of Yosemite Falls, and I was balancing on a very slippery rock to take that photograph. And so it was either get wet and go downstream or get that photograph and jump off the rock. So when you experience what you're painting, you know it. And so when you sit down to paint from a photograph, a source, I knew that stream. I knew that fall because I was about ready to fall. So, you know, it's the movement of that mist from the top of the painting down to the churn of the fall and the water going across that I really appreciate the movement.
As I was preparing for our conversation today, I learned that we have something in common, and that is a deep love for Dr. Seuss. And I wonder if you could talk about how Dr. Seuss influences your work.
Big time. I love Dr. Seuss because there's so much there for adult knowledge of getting back to the simplicities of life, of being kind, showing love, showing respect for others, and just the natural beat of your heart. His works and his rhymes are heartfelt, heart-sent, and when I was in the third grade, I had a very, very bad case of almost scarlet fever, and I took solace in Dr. Seuss books, and I could quote every single Dr. Seuss book, and I could draw everything out of the Dr. Seuss books, and I was creating monsters and creatures like Dr. Seuss, and I was writing poetry and all sorts of things. And so Dr. Seuss brought me through a year-long illness and came out the other side, and wherever you go, there you are.
Another thing that stood out to me about your work and something else that we have in common, you enjoy listening to music while you work, and specifically classical music. You mentioned, I think, Bach and Brahms. And I wonder, how does that put you in the right space to create?
Well, as you know, everything's telling story. And music is a great way to tell story. So is art. And when I listen to classical music, I usually, if I'm having a really nasty day, I'll go up and I'll put on Ode to Joy, because my whole idea of doing art is to be in joy and to express your soul. And that's my favorite piece because it tells its own story of creativity, imagination, and coming to a point where you're in totally a positive mood after maybe not being so grateful. You are very grateful. So that's what Baroque and Bach and Beethoven do for me, because it's very uplifting. And so I always, when I'm teaching, I always tell people to paint up, you know, end your horizon line with a smile. And music ends my painting with a smile.
In addition to being an artist, you're also an author, and you work with animals. Tell me about Fur Shui, please.
Oh, Fur Shui, it's my nonfiction explanation of an introduction to animal feng shui. I'm a feng shui master in Black Hat, and energy flows, and wherever you would like to have it, you can push it, and you can have it flow into more positive and get rid of stagnant places in your life, in your heart, in your home, in your environment. And animals are chi masters. They naturally come into a room and they bust up the energy and they bring forth better energy, or they avoid it. So you need to watch your animals. That book was designed to express to people in a very easy and interesting, lighthearted way of how to move energy within one's office, system, home, environment. And animals just naturally do it. And after watching some animals that I was, I'm an animal communicator and healer. And after interviewing many of my clients, their animals responded to different areas in different ways, which matched the feng shui bagua. And so that was the inspiration for Feng Shui. And our animals give us all the knowledge if we were just wise enough to sit and listen to it. So I always watch where the animals are moving, restaurants and cafes. And I think I'll sit over there because the energy is a little bit better. That dog just brought in some really good stuff.
Thanks to artist Paula Brown and our Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. Paula Brown's work is on display from October 3rd through 31st at the Mezzanine Gallery in Wilmington's Carvel State Building. The exhibition is free. For hours, visit arts.delaware.gov. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we learn about a new living shoreline seeking to protect nature and history on Thompson Island. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Construction has started on the Thompson Island Living Shoreline Project in Rehoboth Beach. The project, on part of Delaware Seashore State Park, is the start of installing devices in the water as a large-scale, nature-based engineering solution to protect the island's shoreline while also enhancing the aquatic environment around the island. For this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Joey Urzeri speaks with the project's manager, Bob Collins, of the Delaware Center for the Inland Bays, about this living shoreline and its expected impact, including the history and cultural significance of Thompson Island it can help preserve.
Construction has now started for the Thompson Island Living Shoreline Project. What is this project?
It's a living shoreline project located in northern Rehoboth Bay, and the project is designed to, for a number of things, but to stop erosion on Thompson Island, which is part of Delaware Seashore State Park, and it's often been referred to as one of the most important cultural assets in the state of Delaware.
Now, you just gave us a little piece of where Thompson Island is. So where is it again exactly there near Delaware Seashore Park?
The island itself is located in northern Rehoboth Bay, right between Dewey Beach and the Lewis and Rehoboth Canal.
Okay, thank you very much for that. What kind of timeline are we looking at for this project? With construction just starting, how long should it take to complete?
Okay, well, this is the first phase of the project, and we hope to be completed by the 15th of October for phase one.
How many different phases are there in this project?
There's a number, but unfortunately right now this is the only one that's funded.
And how's the funding coming in? Where does that go through? Is that through the state, federal grants, a little of everything?
Yeah, it's a combination of state, federal, and even some private grants.
Now, Living Shoreline Project, what are exactly living shorelines? How does that work exactly for people who may not be familiar with it?
Yeah, living shorelines are, we call them natural or nature-based solutions, and they're designed site-specifically for the amount of energy that's in the water, and what we look to do is to mimic nature. This particular project, you know, we're looking to make an artificial reef similar to what an oyster reef would look like, and that'll slow down the wave energy and prevent erosion. Some other tactics in in lower energy situations would include core logs. They could include oyster shells, oyster shell bags, plants, spartina, alterna flora, and spartina patens are often used in these types of projects. This project here is it's a high energy situation, so we're using kind of a big solution on here.
Now, the project is going to use 400 wave attenuation devices. How are they used? What are they for? And, you know, how basically do they function?
They look like a pyramid, and they're about 3.5 feet tall, and they're engineered so that they have baffles or holes that are in the located in the side. What happens is that a wave will or wave energy will hit up against the we call them wads. And it'll dissipate the energy, but it doesn't reflect it straight back. So what you do is you slow the intensity of the energy in the water, but you're not like a seawall or something like that that would just push it straight back and cause erosion in other places. So what this really does is it kind of softens the blow of the wave energy that's coming from the south in Rehoboth Bay.
Has a project like this been done anywhere here in Delaware or in the region or from somewhere else where people can maybe get an idea or they can look up to see how it works?
Yeah, I'm only aware of one other project that has used wads in the inland bays, and that's at a project in Indian River Bay. They have been used up and down the East Coast. I can't give you off the top of my head where any of these other larger projects are.
But it's something that's been done before. This isn't like a new project, a new thing being done here at Thompson Island.
No, it definitely it has been done. And, you know, within the environmental community, living shorelines are really taking hold. And, you know, not only does the state of Delaware have a Living Shoreline Committee that meets quarterly to discuss tactics and implementation and the science of it, there is a, you know, regional group through Restore America's Estuaries that looks at the science of living shorelines and hopefully, you know, installs appropriate measures for the erosion regime that's going on in a particular location.
There's another aspect of this whole project, and it's one maybe people may not think, and that Thompson Island is special for the Nanticoke Indian tribe. What's the cultural significance there?
It's significant, and by no means am I an expert on the indigenous populations here in Delaware. But the history does go back about 3,000 years, where it's been referred to as the paleo-indigenous peoples of the area, primarily the Lenape, and now the Nanticokes, and it's been used for a number of things, but it appears that it was more of a I'm looking for the term that I had here, but basically it was used by small bands that would come to the area. You know, Rehoboth Bay was a great place for oysters and crabs and fish, and so they would come here to enjoy the bounty of the inland bays, if you will, and also their ceremonies within the area. It's an important archaeological area because of the significance to the Nanticokes and the Lenapes.
Was it difficult to come up with a plan for this project that is not only functional, it hits all the environmental guidelines and standards, but still also holds that cultural significance?
Well, it has been a long time coming. One of the most important things that you do on here is you do a site assessment. And that's a very technical document that characterizes everything from the wind, predominant wind energy, soils, natural resource inventory. And that takes a good amount of time and effort. We develop the plan, and going through the permitting process on something like this is extensive, as it should be. We want to make sure that we're not doing more harm than good, and that we want to use appropriate tactics, that we're not adversely affecting, say, horseshoe crabs or, wading birds or those types of things on here. Funding is always an issue. This project is probably going to be about $1 million once it's all said, just this one portion of it. And then implementation. And that's where we are right now. And it's, whenever you're doing work on the water, it can get tricky in relation to winds and tides. And this one's no different. We're dealing with very shallow water, but we're trying to move, structures out there that are, they're a little bit over a ton apiece. You need a qualified marine contractor to do it. So it's been quite a project. And as I said, we really have not found funding for other portions of it, although that's coming up next.
What would be the next portion of the project?
There would be another array of wads in the reef out just south of the of where this current reef is going. This one that we're building now is about 648 linear feet. That one would be much shorter, and that's on the south side of the island where the highest fetch is. Fetch is the length of the length of water over which wind travels before it hits the land, and that generate the more fetch, the more energy wave energy that you tend to get. So on either side, on the west side, on the Rehoboth Lewis Canal, there would be a lower energy, more traditional living shoreline that will involve core logs and oyster shell bags. On the west side, or the east side of the island, it'll be more core logs and smaller structures going in the water. You're not dealing with as much energy now.
Thanks to Bob Collins with the Delaware Center for the Inland Bays and our Joe Irizarry for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Joey Irizarry, Abigail Lee, Martin Matheny, and Sarah Petrowich. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first date of mine.